Basic things that we take for granted are just not available. Sterile suture kits, ketamine, I have to beg for. It's a drug that we use to provide pain relief and sedation when we do basic procedures. But I tend to use it on most pediatric cases when we need to do painful procedures in the emergency department. But they're short on supply, so you have to pick and choose which patients you provide it to and how much you provide, because you know that, it's opportunity cost for another patient. And that's a very hard reality, and it's not one that I've had to deal with before in my career, despite working in humanitarian medicine for a long time. We often have to think about resource limitations, but these particular resource limitations are very difficult to bear. And I should mention that Al-Aqsa Hospital is better off than so many of the other health facilities throughout the Gaza Strip that have either been destroyed or are completely cut off. I mean, you think about the north, Al-Shifa Hospital, the largest hospital, and how cut off it's been from the very beginning, or Al-Nasser Hospital that was besieged for so long, and the healthcare staff inside those institutions not having access to food or water for several days and sometimes weeks. That is a much more extreme situation than that which I'm describing to you at Al-Aqsa Hospital, where, despite me describing severe resource shortages, we were still better off than many of the other areas in the Gaza Strip.
Dr. Tanya Hashhassan, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Pediatric intensive care physician, was in Gaza for 2 weeks with medical aid for Palestinians. She just left on Wednesday. Co-founder of the social media account Gaza Medic Voices, which shares firsthand accounts from healthcare professionals in Gaza, speaking to us from Amman, Jordan. Coming up, we go to a State Department official who just resigned in protest over the Biden administration's support for Israel's assault on Gaza. Back in 20 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
A State Department official working on human rights issues in the Middle East resigned Wednesday in protest against U.S. support for Israel's assault on Gaza. Anel Schielein worked as a foreign affairs officer in the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights and Labor for a year before publicly resigning. In an op-ed published in CNN, she wrote, quote, "For the past year, I worked for the office devoted to promoting human rights in the Middle East. I believe strongly in the mission and in the important work of that office. However, as a representative of a government that is directly enabling what the International Court of Justice has said could plausibly be a genocide in Gaza, such work has become almost impossible. Unable to serve an administration that enables such atrocities, I've decided to resign from my position at the Department of State," she wrote.
Anil Sheilin is the most significant protest resignation over U.S. support for Israel's assault on Gaza since the resignation in October of Josh Paul, the senior State Department official involved in arms transfers to foreign governments. Anil Sheilin joins us now from Washington, D.C. Anil, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you tell us further about the decision you made?
Thanks so much for having me and for your coverage of this issue. I hadn't initially planned to resign publicly. I hadn't been at state for very long, and I didn't think it would necessarily matter. But I decided to go public because when I started to tell colleagues that I was planning to resign over Gaza, so many people's response was, please speak out, please speak for us. Many people are not in a position where they feel they could resign, or they are trying to do what they can on the inside. There's still a lot of important, crucial work the State Department does. And so I decided I would go ahead and go public.
Well, you told, Anil, you told the Washington Post that you tried to raise concerns internally with dissent cables and at staff forums. So what was the result of that? And how are other people within state, as you said, trying to speak out within the State Department to change policy?
Yes, many people are extremely horrified by the U.S. government's position on this horrific conflict and the actions of both the Israeli and the U.S. governments. There is the dissent channel inside the State Department. I co-wrote a cable and signed other cables. There have been forums for State Department employees to speak out. I spoke with supervisors. I was able to speak with senior official about my resignation. I think at the end of the day, many people inside state know that this is a horrific policy and can't believe that the United States government is engaged in such actions that contravene American values so directly, but the leadership is not listening.
I want to go to the State Department spokesperson, Matt Miller, being questioned by a reporter about the internal dissent channel within the State Department and employees raising concerns over the policies.
What is the point of the whole channel?
And like,
I mean, the secretary listens, and we've all reported about various listening sessions between mid-level or like more senior officials with the secretary, more junior officials. If it's not, if it's being heard, but if it's not taken into account in the policy at all,
so
then don't you think it's a little bit pointless?
So I would disagree with that completely. It is taken into account in the policymaking process. The secretary has heard things in those meetings that he takes on board and that influence his thinking and that he brings to bear in making policy decisions. Now, if what you mean is, are we going to execute a complete reversal of the policy
we
implemented, are we going to implement exactly some of the policies that the people in these meetings have called for? That's not how this process works. That's not how government works. That's not how any organization works. I dare say any of the media organizations in this room, if reporters go to their bosses and offer feedback and the bosses say, well, that's a good point, we're going to take that to bear, but on the larger policy, this is the decision that we have made.
That I didn't suggest, but do you have any examples on, you know, any changes?
I will say with respect to any number of issues, with respect to the delivery of humanitarian assistance, we have heard good ideas from people inside the building who have come and offered constructive feedback, and we have implemented those.
So now,
there are people that when you say, if the idea is that to the United States to cut off support for Israel, that's just a fundamental policy disagreement. So when you see people who offer interviews that say we want the United States to stop supporting Israel's right to defend itself, that's not something the secretary agrees with. It's not something the president agrees with. And ultimately, they are the ones who have the responsibility of making those decisions.
So, Anil Sheilin, if you can respond to the State Department spokesperson, Matt Miller.
You know, I think American law is quite clear here. in terms of the Leahy laws, for example, of that when a foreign military is credibly accused of gross human rights violations, the law is that the U.S. will no longer provide weapons to those units, or 620I of the Foreign Assistance Act, that a government that is blocking American humanitarian aid is no longer eligible for U.S. military assistance. These laws are not being applied. So I think this is not only having a horrific effect on the people of Gaza, but in terms of America's standing in the rest of the world. This administration came in pledging to reestablish American moral leadership, re-engagement with the international community, uphold the law and the so-called rules-based liberal international order. And I think it's just become clear that this administration is not, in fact, carrying out any of those pledges. And, you know, my work was on human rights, which is very important work that the State Department does. But I think on this issue in particular, the political calculus has been that U.S. support for Israel is a better political move. But I think what the administration may be starting to see is they may have made the wrong decision on that politically.
And Anel, can you explain whether there's any distinction made? There's a blanket statement about U.S. support for Israel, but is there no distinction within discussions at the State Department between different forms of U.S. support for Israel? So, for instance, obviously in this instance, the most important question is that of military aid to Israel at this moment.
I should be clear that, you know, my area of focus, Israel and Palestine were not part of my portfolio. I was focusing primarily on North Africa. So I can't speak directly to, you know, some of those conversations. I do think, you know, at the end of the day, the U.S.-Israel relationship is considered of such political importance that decisions regarding it are made at the very top. And so while there are other processes and certainly discussions going on inside state, inside other parts of the government about some of those nuances you were discussing, I don't think we're likely to see any public shift on any of that until those decisions come from the top, that they're ready to reimagine the U.S.-Israel relationship.
I wanted to go to another clip of the State Department spokesperson Matt Miller saying the Biden administration has not found Israel's actions in Gaza to be a violation of international law. This is some of what he said.
We have not found them to be in violation of international humanitarian law, either when it comes to the conduct of the war or when it comes to the provision of humanitarian assistance.
That was this week, Anel Sheline. Either violation of international law or when it comes to providing humanitarian assistance. And yet President Biden says he is building a port because the Palestinians cannot get enough aid.
Exactly. I think that the evidence speaks for itself. We've had, you know, not only the ICJ's ruling, not only the UN Security Council ruling. Clearly, the administration is unwilling to admit to reality. And I just want to reiterate, I think this is not only obviously devastating for the lives of people in Gaza, but is doing incredible damage to America's standing on the international stage. It is incredibly demoralizing for people inside the State Department, many of whom believe very deeply in what America says it stands for. So I'm trying to speak on behalf of those many, many people who feel so betrayed by our government stance.
And Anel, could you explain the effect that the massive protests across the United States have had within the State Department, what discussion there was of them, and then, of course, the uncommitted vote?
So within the State Department, you know, civil servants are very committed to their role of being non-political, of following the instruction that they receive. Within state, people are aware of what's going on outside, but, you know, this is not the first time that people have been involved or had to carry out policies they perhaps did not agree with. And it is something that many of these people have signed up for. This is the role of carrying out America's foreign policy. On this issue, I think because it has been so horrific and because we are seeing such growing political pushback from the American public, people are increasingly frustrated. You know, many other people with whom I spoke said they're considering resigning. But again, it is challenging for someone to, you know, it's not easy to not have a job in this country.
I wanted to quote further what you've said in explanation of why you're resigning. You said you're haunted by the final social media post of Aaron Bushnell, the 25-year-old U.S. Air Force serviceman who self-immolated in front of the Israeli embassy in Washington on February 25th. You quote him, "Many of us like to ask ourselves, what would I do if I was alive during slavery or the Jim Crow South or apartheid? What would I do if my country was committing genocide?" The answer is, you're doing it right now. If you can explain what that meant to you and how people have responded to you.
Sorry. That post, I think, spoke to me and many people who had to really look at what they were doing, and whether, for me, I have a young daughter, and I thought about in the future, if she were to ask me, you know, what were you doing when this was happening? You were at the State Department. I want to be able to tell her that I didn't stay silent. So I know many people who are deeply affected by those words that Aaron Bushnell posted. And I do think people are trying to do what they can. There is still very important work being done inside the State Department. But I do think until our top levels of leadership are ready to make a change, there's very little that the rank and file are able to do.
Anil Sheline, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Anil has just resigned from the State Department in protest of U.S. support for Israel's war on Gaza. She worked as foreign affairs officer in the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor. She's also the first State Department official to publicly resign since Josh Paul did months ago. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we speak to the spokesperson for UNRWA. President Biden just signed off on a bipartisan bill, turning it into law, which says that UNRWA will not be funded by the U.S. government for the next year. Stay with us. Shobidor El Amel, What Harm is Hope, by Darbet Shams. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Narmin Sheikh.
Despite a UN-backed report that found famine is imminent in northern Gaza, Israeli authorities informed the United Nations on Sunday that it will no longer approve the passage of any UNRWA food convoys into northern Gaza. This is Israeli spokesperson David Mentz speaking to reporters on Monday.
UNRWA are part of the problem, and we will now stop working with them. We are actively phasing out the use of UNRWA because they perpetuate the conflict rather than try and alleviate the conflict.
In response to the news, UNRWA Commissioner General Philippe Lazzarini wrote in a social media post, quote, "This is outrageous and makes it intentional to obstruct life-saving assistance during a man-made famine. These restrictions must be lifted." UNRWA is the largest organization with the highest reach to displaced communities in Gaza. By preventing UNRWA to fulfill its mandate in Gaza, the clock will tick faster towards famine and many more will die of hunger, dehydration and lack of shelter, he wrote.
The decision came as President Biden signed a $1.2 trillion appropriations bill that strips funding to UNRWA for the next year. The U.S. first suspended aid to UNRWA in late January when the Israeli government leveled allegations that 12 of the agency's 30,000 employees were involved in the Hamas attacks of October 7th. The unsubstantiated allegation prompted other top donors, such as Germany, the European Union, and Sweden, to cut funding to UNRWA, although a number of countries have recently announced their intention to resume funding. For more, we go to Amman, Jordan, where we're joined by Tamara Al-Rifai. She's spokesperson for the UN Palestinian Agency, UNRWA. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Tamara. If you can start off by talking about the significance of what the U.S. has done. President Biden signed off on a bipartisan law that dealt with a lot of issues, but among them, cutting off aid to UNRWA for the next year. And the U.S. is by far the largest funder of this UN Palestinian Relief Agency.
Thanks, Amy, and thanks, as always, for giving UNRWA this platform. The decision by Congress and consequently by the U.S. government to stop funding to UNRWA this year is a huge blow. There is no sugarcoating. The impact on our finances is huge. And also the impact on the politics around UNRWA, seeing our largest donor and many times our closest partner withhold funding, which means withhold trust to UNRWA, is a huge blow to us. However, I also want to say that in parallel, several governments, European and non-European, have either much increased their funding to UNRWA or have given us money for the first time. Also, we are getting overwhelming individual support donations from $10 to $20,000 to our campaigns and our drives. And that speaks for a sentiment that is also galvanizing around UNRWA, around its role, and mostly around the fact that it is not possible to just decide to pull the plug on a UN agency. Any change to the way a UN agency works, especially as UNRWA gets its mandate from the UN General Assembly, should be discussed at the General Assembly. It is not about one or two UN member states to decide whether UNRWA can continue working or not. This is a global decision. At the General Assembly is where we get an overwhelming vote of support. And that is where such a conversation should take place.
Mara, could you talk about the countries that have that had previously rescinded funding to UNRWA and may now have either resumed it or intend to resume it?
Yes, I can talk about a few countries that just over the last few days made their contributions to UNRWA. Germany, for example, which, by the way, had not really suspended its funding. It just took a little bit of a pause to think. And they just announced, Germany just announced $45 million in income to UNRWA just in the last few days. The same, Canada, Australia, Sweden, and a number of other countries that had initially withheld their funding to UNRWA following these allegations, around 12 of 13,000 staff members in Gaza, now are releasing their funding. But I also want to talk about the role of Ireland or Spain, both of them having much increased their funding to UNRWA and also their political support. The European Union, our second largest donor as a group, did release the large part of its funding to UNRWA. And also countries like Qatar, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and just today Kuwait All of them are supporting UNRWA, and again, income from private sources, from individuals and foundations, has skyrocketed since the beginning of this year, especially now during Ramadan, where many Muslims around the world are looking for a zakat-friendly way, so a way to donate as per Islamic Sharia law. We have this mechanism, and many, many Muslims from around the world, from Malaysia to Indonesia to Singapore, are donating to UNRWA.
Canada as well, hasn't it said it's restoring UNRWA aid?
Sweden, you said? I couldn't
Canada?
Hear you. Oh, yes, Canada did restore its funding, yes.
So if you could say, also speak, Tamara, about the fact that Israel has now said it will no longer approve any UNRWA food convoys to the north. What are the implications of that?
The implications are huge. In the last few days alone, we received five denials to our requests to move food from the south of the Gaza Strip in Rafah to the north. Now, we've also, so we consider this to be a ban on UNRWA's food distribution in the north. The Commissioner General of UNRWA, Philippe Lazzarini, was also denied access to Gaza 2 weeks ago, despite having followed the usual procedures to ask for him and his delegation to go into Gaza. What we're truly seeing here is the space around UNRWA in Gaza is really shrinking, and our ability to adequately continue saving lives is really being obstructed. We're talking here about food distribution to an entire population that is food insecure. Food insecure in lay woman terms means people are hungry. Half of that population no longer has access to any food. There's nothing in their pantries. 75% or more of the population is displaced. Most of these people displaced are now in Rafah, which has witnessed a six-fold increase in the population. Many of these people are in UNRWA shelters where they do receive food, vaccines, and medical treatment. And many, many of them are in tents in Rafah. When I last was in Gaza, what I saw in Rafah was an immense tented community out in the open. Many people have gathered around UNRWA shelters hoping they would receive some of the aid that UNRWA distributes. What's going to happen to UNRWA if we can no longer truly operate?
I wanted to play a clip of independent Senator Bernie Sanders. You know, this was a $1.2 trillion appropriations bill that keeps the government open through October, but it includes stripping funding to UNRWA. The bill vote 74 to 24. Bernie Sanders voted no because of the stripping of funding to UNRWA.
Tens of thousands of people are starving. UNRWA is trying to feed them, and the Israeli government and its allies like AIPAC spend much of their time lobbying to defund UNRWA, the major organization which is feeding starving people. Sadly, tragically, many members of Congress seem to be happy to be part of this starvation caucus.
So, Tamara Arafai, if you can respond, and also the fact that the 30,000-member agency UNRWA is not just supporting the people who face famine in Gaza, but also throughout the Middle East. We're talking about Lebanon and Jordan. We have 30
seconds.
That's
a great point. That's a great point, Amy, to remind that UNRWA is the agency that is fully in charge of Palestine refugees, from registering them and their descendants to offering a very sturdy education system to them through 700 schools, to offering all primary health care. So stripping UNRWA of funding not only shrinks its ability to respond to the looming famine in Gaza, but also puts at risk the schools, the access of kids to proper education, the vaccines, the mother and child care, everything across the region, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and Gaza.
We want to thank you, Tamara Arafai, a spokesperson for UNRWA, the United Nations Agency for Palestine Refugees. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Shruf Abdokadus, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Ndura, Sam Alkoff, Tay Maria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Hello, this is Kelly from the Peak Publication Society, SFU student-led newspaper. Recently, news organizations have been facing issues sharing news content. All news outlets, including small publications like us, have been affected due to Meta's refusal to comply with the Online News Act and compensate news companies. We have been serving our diverse student community for years and need your support to continue. If you'd like to contribute as a paid writer, illustrator, or photographer, follow us on Instagram at @thepeak@SFU. Keep reading our stories at the-peak.ca. If Meta is listening, we're just a community promoting SFU events. Please don't block us again.
Hey folks, Joey.